This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
I'm looking for the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. I'm your host, Chuck Tomasi, and with me is my partner, Craig Stepp. If you're new to Technorama, thank you for joining us. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. We appreciate you giving us your time. We are absolutely thrilled to have with us today Dr. Michio Kaku. Dr. Kaku is a theoretical physicist, best-selling author, and popularizer of science. He's the co-founder of string field theory, a branch of string theory, and continues Einstein's search to unite the four fundamental forces of nature into one unified theory. He's appeared on television on the Discovery Channel, BBC, ABC, Science Channel, and CNN, to name a few, written for popular science publications like Discover, Wired, and New Scientist, been featured on documentaries like Me and Isaac Newton, and hosted many of his own, including BBC's recent series on Time. It's our pleasure to have with us today Dr. Michio Kaku. Good morning, Dr. Kaku. How are you?
Very good.
Could you tell the listener a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a professor of theoretical physics, and my goal in life is to complete Einstein's dream of a theory of everything that is an equation no more than 1 inch long that would allow us to, quote, read the mind of God, summarize all physical law into one comprehensive theory. That's my goal in life.
And I thought I had goals. Sheesh.
Nothing like mine. Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb, you said in the book he was your mentor. What was that like?
Well, yes. When I was in high school, I used to read a lot of science fiction and dream about going into outer space and watching Flash Gordon and things. But I also realized that my parents were very poor. In fact, during World War II, they were incarcerated in a relocation camp in California.
Oh, my goodness.
So I realized very early in life that if I were to do anything at all, I would have to do it myself. So when I was in high school, I built an atom smasher.
Wow.
I went to my mom, and I said, Mom, I want to build a 2.3 million electron volt betatron pod accelerator in the garage.
That's nice, dear.
And yeah, go ahead and play.
And my mom said, sure, and take out the garbage. Yeah. So I went out and took the garbage and built a 6-kilowatt, 2.3 million electron volt particle accelerator in the garage. Every time I plugged it in, I would blow out every single circuit breaker in the house. All the lights would go dark. And then my poor mom would say, how come I couldn't have a son who plays basketball? Maybe if I buy him a baseball. And why can't he find a nice Japanese girl? I mean, what's wrong with my son? Well, I went to the National Science Fair, and then Edward Teller came by, and he immediately knew what I was doing. I didn't have to explain to him what an accelerator was. I didn't have to explain to him what the nucleus of the atom was, and I was working with antimatter, so I didn't have to explain to him what antimatter was. He immediately knew what I was doing, and he put me on his TV show, and afterwards he arranged for me to get a 4-year scholarship to Harvard so I could complete my dream of working in physics. Years later, in fact, decades later, I realized that he was actually recruiting for the Star Wars program. There's a book called Star Warriors where they actually talk about how he set up a scholarship that I received to steer people to weapons work.
Fast forward a little bit, you've got a new book titled Physics of the Impossible, A Scientific Exploration into the World of Phasers, Force Fields, and Time Travel. That's a title that I think every Technorama listener must have on their must-read list. Can you tell us what kind of things we can look forward to seeing in that book?
Well, I discussed the physics, the science behind teleportation, invisibility, ray guns, force fields, time machines, interdimensional travel. And the reason why I did this is because when I was a child, I used to read the Foundation series of Isaac Asimov.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're thrust into a world that's not 100 years ahead, like Flash Gordon, but 10,000, 50,000 years ahead. And you have to then ask the question, if you're 50,000 years ahead of us in technology, what kinds of technologies are allowed by the laws of physics and which ones are not? And so I decided to rank impossibilities, class 1, class 2, class 3 infinities, I mean impossibilities. A class 1 impossibility, for example, is something that would take 10 years, 50 years, 100 years to accomplish. But it's possible. It's an engineering problem. Class 2 impossibilities may take 1,000, 10,000 years. And class 3 impossibilities are just downright impossible, violate all known laws of physics. And much to my surprise, I found out that most of the technologies you see in science fiction, you know, telepathy, psychokinesis, invisibility, teleportation, ray guns, force fields, are in fact class 1 impossibilities. That is, within 100 years, we may have the ability to make things totally invisible, to teleport simple objects across distances, and to perhaps send the first probe to the distant stars.
You also describe underneath this type 1, 2, and 3 civilizations as part of the groundwork for this book. Can you let the listener know what those are?
Right. When we physicists analyze intelligent life in outer space, we don't talk about little green men. We rank them according to energy consumption. A type 1 civilization harnesses planetary power. For example, they control the weather or manipulate the weather. They can mine the oceans, control volcanoes and earthquakes. That's a type 1 civilization. Type 2 is stellar. They harness the power of an entire star. They play with stars. Star Trek, for example, the Federation of Planets, mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. emerging type 2 civilization. And then we have type 3, which is galactic. They roam the space lanes of the entire galaxy. And they can harness the power of 10 billion stars, the power of an entire galaxy. We, by the way, on this scale are type 0. We get our energy from dead plants. We're not even on the radar screen. We're just a blip on the radar screen. Right. We're just ants in an anthill, you know, compared to these guys. But, you know, if you're type 1 and you're 100, 200 years ahead of us, you probably will have the ability to make objects invisible, to teleport simple objects, the ability to have force fields. That's class 1 impossibilities. Class 2 impossibilities are really for type 2 and type 3 civilizations. That is, time travel, faster than light travel through wormholes, interdimensional transport. But there are some things that even a type 3 civilization cannot harness. And these are class 3 infinities, I mean impossibilities, mm-hmm. which include, for example, violating the conservation of matter and energy. That is, perpetual motion machines. Perpetual motion machines violate every known law of physics. And so we probably will not expect anyone to announce energy for free anytime soon, at yeah. least within the next 10,000 years.
Do you find it hard to suspend belief when you watch movies?
Well, yeah, it is possible to use science to analyze science fiction. For example, whenever I see a science fiction movie and the aliens come out, the first thing I say to myself, are the aliens type 1, type 2, or type 3? That's the first thing I ask myself, right?
Identification.
Yeah. So, you know, like Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon, that would be a typical type 1 civilization. You know, they have rocket ships, they can go anywhere on the planet Earth, and they can, you know, control volcanoes, earthquakes, tornadoes, and the weather to a degree. That's a type 1 civilization. And then, you know, again, if you watch Star Trek, you know, on Star Trek, they do play with individual stars. They can ignite a star. There's one episode where they actually ignite a star.
Mm-hmm.
But they've only colonized a tiny fraction of the galaxy, the so-called alpha sector of the galaxy. But then there's a civilization that eats type 2 civilizations for breakfast, the Borg.
Mm-hmm.
These
yep.
are the people that everyone fear, the Borg. They're the ones that, you know, can devour the whole Federation. They're type 3. The Borg is a type 3 civilization. But then one day, a little kid came up to me when I was speaking in London at the planetarium, and he tugged on my leg, a little 10-year-old kid, and he said, Professor, you're wrong. You're totally uh-huh. wrong, Professor. There's type 4. There's type 4. So I was thinking of going down to this little kid and saying to him, shut up, kid. What do you know? You don't know anything about physics.
I love your professional attitude.
Right. So I thought to myself, I'm going to say to that, this to this kid, there are only planets, stars, and galaxies. There's no Type 4. So he kept tugging on my pants, and he said, no, Professor, you're wrong. There's Type 4, the Q. And I said to myself, oh, my God, this kid's right. The Q, if you watch Star Trek,
yes.
They're mm-hmm. gods, basically. They're godlike creatures that they play with galaxies. And so if you're extra galactic, you're basically Type 4. And the energy necessary for a Type 4 civilization would be dark energy, something that we physicists only discovered in the last 5 years. The energy of nothing, the energy of the vacuum, is the largest source of energy in the universe. 73% of the universe is made out of dark energy. And that could be the reservoir for a Type 4 civilization.
Uh-oh, we got to update the book.
No, I put the Type 4 inside the book.
I'm Dr. Robert Ballard, and I'm an explorer in residence for the National Geographic Society and deeply enjoy this program.
Wait, Dr. Cocker, I wanted to ask you about, and recently in the news, the U.S. Shot down the satellite that was coming down.
That's
I was curious if you had any thoughts on that. Because I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yes, I mean, let's be very blunt about this. War happens to be the engine for much of science and technology, which is very sad. World mm-hmm. War I accelerated the use of gunpowder, machine guns, Gatling guns, submarines, and tanks. World War II, of course, put into motion poison gas and aircraft carriers and airplanes, saturation bombing, and the atomic bomb. And now some people think that space war could be the next war on the horizon. And anyone who controls outer space really controls the so-called high frontier, the high terrain. And personally, I think we should have an outer space treaty, like the 1967 treaty that banned weapons in outer space. Because the transition from Type 0, where we are now, to Type 1 is not guaranteed. We are about 100 years from being a Type 1 civilization, a planetary civilization. For example, what is the Internet? The Internet is a Type 1 telephone system.
Mm-hmm.
The language of Type 1 will be English. Okay. Culture, oh my God, the culture of Type 1 will be rock and roll, rap music, and MTV.
I'm
Holy
scared.
Moly. So that's the culture of Type 1. And the European Union, these countries have hated each other for thousands of years. They're now part of the European Union. And why are these countries part of the European Union? Because they're competing with NAFTA. They're competing with us. We are NAFTA. So we're seeing the beginning of a Type 1 civilization. However, the transition is not guaranteed. Every time I read the newspaper, I realize that every single headline points to this transition to Type 1. Telecommunications, satellites, English, globalization, the economy, rock and roll, everything points to the emergence of a Type 1 civilization. But the transition is not guaranteed. We could have a war, or there are some people who actually don't like a Type 1 civilization, and these are the terrorists. If you read the works of the terrorists, they oppose modernity. They oppose the tolerance, the progressiveness, the scientific freewheeling attitude of a Type 1 civilization. And they want to go back to a Type minus 1 civilization. They want to go back into prehistory, practically. So we see this march to Type 1. It is the greatest transition in the history of the human race. And we are privileged to be alive to watch this greatest transition in the history of the human race. It's happening right before our eyes. Every headline of the newspaper points to the birth pangs of a Type 1 civilization.
I'll agree with that. It really is fascinating. If you just take a step back and just think, what does it take to make a cell phone call from me to you? Or send an email. It just boggles the mind sometimes that any of this works at all.
Right, and it's the emergence of a planetary communication system. Telecommunications, cell phones, the internet, all part of a Type 1 communication system. And if you think about it, every headline points to the birth pangs of a planetary this, a planetary that. And we're here to watch this transition. Now, the transition will take about 100 years, so we're just in the beginning of it. But you can imagine what the world's going to be like in 100 years. And again, most of the technologies that I mention in the book, class one in possibilities, most of those technologies will, in fact, be available.
That feeds in well to my next question. When you wrote about creating silicon wafers for chips, you said that the wavelength is the key to etching these, and you said there was a major breakthrough that we can now use visible light to do this. Is there some major benefit to visible light, or is it just that it's a shorter wavelength and can make higher density?
Yeah, Moore's Law, which is, says that computer power doubles every 18 months, mm-hmm. is the foundation of modern technology. That's why we're talking on the telephone today. That's why we have the internet, lasers. All of it depends on chips, okay? These chips have transistors that you could put about 10 million of them on your thumb. And how do we create 10 million transistors on a wafer the size of your thumb? By using ultraviolet radiation, by using tiny little light beams to gouge out the wires and the transistors. Now we're using that same technology to make objects invisible. This is just a few months old. In fact, my book is the first one to talk about this. We can now make objects invisible to microwaves. But, you know, we don't use microwave radiation to see. We use light to see things, right?
Right.
Well,
right.
Just a few months ago, proof of principle was demonstrated. Two groups using red lasers and green lasers, using this etching technology found in the computer industry, were able to make tiny little etching on a transparent material, shine light on it, and the light bent the wrong way, consistent with making an object invisible.
Hmm.
Now, if light were to flow around an object, just like water flows around a boulder, and you are downstream from the boulder, you do not know there's a boulder upstream because the water has wrapped around the boulder and reformed. Now, if light can do that around Harry Potter, then Harry Potter is invisible. Because if you look at Harry Potter, light has wrapped around him, and mm-hmm. you can't see him. You see behind Harry Potter. That's been done with microwave radiation. And just a few months ago, we had a proof of principle that you could do this with red light and green light. So I suspect that within 10 years, we'll be able to make the first object invisible to at least one color, like, for example, red laser light. We'll be able to literally make an object disappear. And, of course, who's funding this? The Pentagon. The Pentagon is quite interested in this.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not stupid, right? I mean, after all,
you're right.
If you can make a soldier invisible, think of the havoc you can wreak if you could do
that. Oh, man, gosh. Well, speaking of that, what items in your book frighten you?
Well, these technologies are still in their infancy. Take a look, for example, at teleportation. Mm-hmm. There's a movie called Jumper.
Right.
And I talked to the director, in fact, of the movie. And he told me that if you could really jump from one place to the other, you could destroy nations. You could jump right into the car of the president of a country and assassinate them and jump right out. You could jump right into the vault of a bank, steal the money, and jump out. In fact, that's what they do in the movie. You could topple nations. You could topple governments just by jumping in and jumping out again immediately.
Kidnapping somebody?
Yep. Yeah, so teleportation is more than just the benign technology of Star Trek. It's the power of a god. If you read the Bible, there's even a passage in the Bible where an angel apparently disappears and reappears someplace else. So that's the first mention of teleportation, which is in the Bible, and it's the power of a god. The gods do this all the time. They disappear and they reappear someplace else. That's what gods do, right? So teleportation now is being done in the laboratory at the atomic scale, to be sure. We can now teleport photons underneath the Danube River. In fact, I was in Vienna last year taping with BBC television, and I visited the laboratory at the University of Vienna where... sure enough, the laser apparatus was connected to a tunnel. The tunnel went underneath the Danube River, and they zapped a particle of light right underneath the Danube River. We can now do that with individual cesium atoms. We can actually teleport them. Molecules are harder. We will probably teleport the first molecule in 10 years. Okay, maybe the first virus, or DNA within this century. Like teleporting Captain Kirk, that's a tall order. Captain Kirk has trillions and trillions of atoms, so that's going to be a little bit further down the line. But remember, Star Trek takes place in the 23rd century.
We've got time.
That gives us a few more centuries to play with.
Well, I'm not sure if we can get his ego through the transporter, though. That's pretty big.
That would violate the laws of physics. By the way, I was on StarTrek.com, and I have, of course, much respect for William Shatner. But he was on StarTrek.com answering all the questions from the Trekkies. And they told me that he was getting very frustrated because all the Trekkies kept asking him about antimatter and the fourth dimension. And and finally, Shatner said, he said, damn it, I'm an actor. I know nothing about these things. Get a scientist to answer these questions.
Oh, he's got a great sense of humor, too.
Well, they contacted me, so I appeared on StarTrek.com to answer the questions of the Trekkies.
That's pretty cool.
Well, you mentioned one of my favorite quotes in your book, that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. I know I'm going to get some controversial email on this, but have you considered that some of the stories in the Bible, as you mentioned, may have been about advanced civilization, like ascending into heaven and angels appearing and things like that?
Well, I'm a scientist, and we believe in reproducible results, okay? So, for example, if you said you saw a UFO last night, maybe you did, maybe you didn't, okay? But as a scientist, I'm bound by the criterion of reproducibility, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you did see an angel last night. Maybe you had a very interesting conversation with an angel, but I have no reproducible evidence. For example, if you've been abducted by aliens in outer space, it would be nice if you had an alien chip. One little alien chip, an alien technology, a piece of technology would clinch it right there. Or if forbidden experiments had been done on your unmentionable parts, maybe alien DNA. One shred of alien DNA would settle the entire question once and for all. And so the same thing about the Bible. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, who knows? But the criterion of a scientist is it has to be testable, it has to be reproducible. Otherwise, all we scientists could say is maybe.
Good answer.
This is David Levy, amateur astronomer, lover of the night sky, and comet discoverer. You are listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Regarding death rays and lightsabers, which I always often want, and I've always wanted a lightsaber since I was a kid, so I need to ask you, what are some of the limitations for keeping me from having a lightsaber or a death ray?
Okay. It turns out that we can actually make a ray gun that you can hold in your hand that would blast a hole right through concrete. So then the question is, well, why don't they market these things at the local store? I mean, all sorts of crazies get access to firearms and shoot up schools, right?
Sure.
Well, the problem is, in order to have a ray gun with the power of a nuclear power plant behind you, you have to have a nuclear power plant behind you.
Right.
There is no known portable power pack. That's the key. People forget this. I mean, they always forget, you know, the battery, right? We can create ray guns. The problem is that there's no miniaturized power pack that has that amount of energy that you can put in your hand. The only known portable source of energy is a hydrogen bomb. Now, a hydrogen bomb will do more than just destroy your enemy. It'll also destroy your neighborhood city.
Sure.
But that is the only known portable power pack that you can put, you know, that you can hold, which has that kind of power. So for many decades into the future, we're not going to have portable ray guns. Even though the military can create them, they're useless because you have to have gigantic power plants sitting behind you. So the solution could be nanotechnology. Nanotechnology is still in its infancy, but nanotechnology is the ability to manipulate individual atoms. If we can manipulate individual atoms, in principle, you would have the power of a god. You'd be able to take any object, say, mumbo jumbo, abracadabra, and poof, it would turn into something else. Because you have, in principle, the possibility of manipulating every single atom in that object and rearranging the atoms. That's the power of a god. We don't have that power. Nanotechnology is in its infancy at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
But you can imagine that within 50 to 100 years, with advances in nanotechnology, we may be able to get lots of power packed in a small area. That's why, for example, the automobile industry has always been balking at electric cars. It's very difficult to get that amount of electricity stored in a battery. And that's why hybrid cars, for example, use a gasoline engine as well as an ordinary electric battery. So that's a technical problem, but it's a very big technical problem. And as far as lightsabers, One way to create a lightsaber is to have plasma. Now, when the lightsaber first came out, a lot of people poo-pooed it and said ridiculous because light is not a solid.
Right.
And even if you did have a lightsaber, how would you connect the end of it so the light goes back and forth, back and forth? Well, there's a simple way to do this with plasmas. Plasma is superheated material like the sun. The sun is made out of plasma. Mm-hmm. The inside of an old-fashioned TV set is made out of plasma. Lightning bolts are made out of plasma. They're disassociated ions. So if you simply get a rod with holes in it and you inject a plasma inside that rod, you could create a lightsaber. It would be very hot. It would be comfortable to touch.
Right.
But in principle, you could create something that will slice through ordinary materials. So lightsabers, in fact, are possible. The only problem is, again, the power pack. You have to have a nuclear power plant behind you to energize your plasma, which is not very convenient if you're fighting Darth Vader.
Yeah, right. Hold on, let me turn this on.
That was the disclaimer on the commercial. Nuclear power plant not included.
So again, a lot of these inventions are in fact possible, but the energy supply is a problem. For example, take a look at time travel. Believe it or not, we physicists believe that it may be possible to create a time machine. There's no law of physics saying you can't do it. But the problem is the gasoline, the energy, the power supply. You'd need the energy of a star, and that would require a Type 2, maybe a Type 3 civilization. So everything we've talked about so far, a Type 1 civilization can build in maybe 50 to 100 years. But when it comes to time travel, you're not talking about something that requires maybe Type 3 technology. These are what I call Class 2 impossibilities, technologies that require you to manipulate the power of a star.
About time travel, you think it's possible. What kind of implications do you think that would have? How about that?
Well, some people think that if time machines were as common as car dealerships, then history would be impossible to write. Every time you wrote a history of Cleopatra, there'd be 1,000 tourists wanting to take pictures of Cleopatra, getting in the way, messing up all sorts of stuff. And history would be rewritten every time somebody got into a time machine.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we're speaking English, but if somebody went back to the Battle of Waterloo and scared the troops of the British and Napoleon won, we'd be speaking French right now. Or you go back even earlier to the Armada of Queen Elizabeth I, you scare her ships, and all of a sudden we're speaking Spanish right now. So how do you resolve the paradox of going backwards in time and killing your parents before you're born? If you kill your parents before you're born, how can you be born in the first place to go backwards in time to kill your parents before you're born? Well, there is a resolution to this, and the resolution comes from the quantum theory. Time is a river. We are all swept up in the river of time. But the new wrinkle on all this is that the river of time may fork into two rivers. And if you were a time traveler, you were essentially going from one branch to another branch. So when you go backwards in time and meet Napoleon, that's not really Napoleon. Looks like him, genetically equivalent, but it's not really him. It's somebody else's Napoleon. Or if you meet your parents before you're born, they certainly look like your parents. You know, the teenager, the girl falls in love with you. Well, certainly looks like your mother as a teenager, right? But it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Your timeline is fixed. You have branched off into another timeline. So in a parallel universe, that's where you are. In fact, there's one scene in Back to the Future Part 2 where Doc Brown actually goes to the blackboard, draws a horizontal line,
mm-hmm.
that's a timeline, and then a fork in that timeline, so you have a Y configuration, and he says that we have created a new timeline, and that's how we resolve these paradoxes. So you don't really change the past, you change somebody else's past.
There's just so many implications around that, it makes the mind boggle when you start thinking about, you know, the temporal changes and all that good stuff.
I know. My head's shutting down now.
In fact, the simplest consequence of this is that there are other parallel universes. And this, of course, is one of the hottest areas in physics, if you follow physics.
Mm-hmm.
We physicists don't really believe in a universe anymore. We believe in a multiverse. Our universe is a soap bubble of some sort. We live on the skin of the soap bubble. The soap bubble is expanding. That gives us the Big Bang Theory. But we now think that there are other soap bubbles out there. In fact, Big Bangs are probably happening all the time. Universes are probably being created even as we speak. And then the question is, who lives on these other universes? Is Elvis Presley still alive on another universe? Well, in principle, yeah. According to the quantum theory, according to what is called decoherence theory, a branch of quantum theory, anything that can happen might happen in some universe, in which case, yeah, Elvis Presley could still be alive in another universe. Boggles the mind.
It does.
Or maybe there's another universe where a cosmic ray went through Hitler's mother, and one cosmic ray will cause a miscarriage. So in that particular universe, we are just one cosmic ray separated from a universe where World War II never took place. Or for that matter, if a cosmic ray went through Churchill's mother, or Roosevelt's mother, maybe we'll all be speaking German right now. Boggles the mind.
You know, and even in some of these other rivers, it could be just a total different path altogether if something happened way in the past, and then none of this would have been here. Maybe dinosaurs would be ruling the earth.
Yeah, if you had gone backwards in the past and stepped on a rodent by accident, who happens to be your great-great-great-grandmother many times removed, you just destroyed the entire human race.
The butterfly effect.
And we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as bizarre as all this sounds, we physicists take these things very seriously. This is part of what is called the multiverse theory, and it is now, I think, the dominant theory in quantum cosmology. It's taken very seriously by physicists.
There's just so much more we could go into about antimatter and negative matter and space travel. Unfortunately, we don't have the time for it today. But where can people find updates as breakthroughs on topics like this or new discoveries are made?
Well, you can go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And in it, I have a little section where I take some of the top science stories of the week and have a quick summary of some of these stories. And the website, well, we average about 1 million page hits per month on that website. It's very active.
I'm one.
And we even have a chat room, so you can chat with other, geeky science fiction readers and learn about the science behind what you see in Hollywood movies and in fiction and novels.
Have you thought about a periodic audio program, such as a podcast, to provide updates?
No, not yet. I'm basically a research physicist. I spend most of my time, thinking about Einstein's unified field theory. And there are only so many hours out of the day.
That's true.
There's only so much an individual can do.
I mean, you should be able to time travel by now. You should be able to make some time.
Yeah, I guess if I clone myself and go backwards in time, and then I'll have several of myself doing all these things. That's within the laws of physics, I suppose.
So, yeah.
Could be a possibility.
The Large Hadron Colliders, what are they trying?
Large Hadron Collider, right.
Yeah, what are they trying to achieve, actually?
Well, this is the biggest machine of science ever built by the human race. It's 17 miles in circumference, and we were supposed to have ours in Dallas, Texas, but it was canceled. In fact, at the last day of hearings, a congressman asked the physicist, "Will we find God with your machine? If so, I will vote for it." Well, the physicist didn't know how to answer this question. This is the biggest atom smasher ever conceived of to be built outside Dallas, Texas. He didn't know how to answer it, so the machine was canceled. Ever since then, we physicists have tried to rerun that scene in our minds over and over again. How would we have answered that question? Will we find God with your machine? I would have answered it like this. I would have said, God, by whatever signs or symbols you ascribe to the deity, this machine will get you as close as humanly possible to his greatest creation, Genesis. This is a Genesis machine. We hope to recreate a fraction of God's greatest creation, the universe. That's how I would have answered that question. And that's what the Large Hadron Collider is all about. It's a Genesis machine. We hope to recreate a teeny-weeny little piece of the Big Bang. And it's not dangerous because cosmic rays from outer space hit the Earth with much more energy than we can muster with our puny Large Hadron Collider. But it's the biggest we can do, 17 miles in circumference, bigger than the city of Geneva. You can put Geneva inside the machine.
Wow.
And it gets turned on sometime around summertime. And we physicists hope to discover what are called sparticles, superparticles, They are higher vibrations of a superstring. And that's what I do for a living. That's my day job, working on superstring theory, which we think is the theory of everything.
You certainly have given some food for great sci-fi writers to base their stories on, like aiming dying stars as gamma ray burster weapons, or the remote possibility of waking up on a distant planet, or harvesting antimatter from anti-stars. There's just so much good stuff in there that, you know, you could just base an entire story right on, or maybe one story on all of them.
And remember, it's based on real science. This is not fiction. I'm a physicist, a working physicist. This is real fact that we're talking about, extrapolated into the future.
We appreciate you being here. It's just been great. Again, there's so much more stuff we could go into, but unfortunately, the time doesn't allow for it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Okay, my pleasure.
Once again, we'd like to thank Dr. Michio Kaku for joining us on Technorama, and thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed the show and would like to comment, you can check out our blog at chuckchat.com, where you'll also find links to Dr. Kaku's book. You can also leave us a voicemail on the listener line at 206-222-CHAT. That's 206-222-2428. We'd love to hear from you. Or send us an email at technorama@chuckchat.com. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more about the great audio lineup and postings at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with a host of great content at Farpoint Media. You can find them at farpointmedia.net. That does it for this time, and until next time, tell a friend about Technorama, and as usual, our traditional sign-off, a binary high-five, 101.
Excited about the news surrounding the Large Hadron Collider? Want to get in on the action with your own subatomic discoveries but can't get to Geneva, Switzerland all that often? Now you can do the same experiments as the professional physicist with HADI, the Little Hadron Collider from WAMCO.
Do you want to know what it is?
HADI is the perfect gift for any physicist or people who just like to play with potentially dangerous things. Just 1 meter in diameter and operating on a single 9-volt battery, HADI allows the scientist in your family to look for things like the elusive Higgs boson. Just add ice cubes in the hopper and salt water in the reservoir, then flip the switch. Through a series of systems like the Mini Proton Synchrotron, the Super Mini Proton Synchrotron, and the Technorometron, your little HADI can start to unlock the secrets of the universe right in your own home. And HADI doesn't cost billions and take over a decade to assemble like the Large Hadron Collider. HADI assembles in minutes and is available for just 3 easy payments of $99.95. Order your Little Hadron Collider today. Shipping and handling not included. 9-volt battery sold separately. Warning, people with pacemakers should not use the Little Hadron Collider.